Welcome, everyone, to the Township's Daily News Bits. I'm Holly Bailey, bringing you news and events that matter to townshipers through the Local Journalism Initiative, funded by the Government of Canada. On November 18th, head to Bishop's University as the Eastern Townships Resource Centre presents the Robin Burns Lecture as part of the Humanities Festival. Professor Dr. Natalie Cook will be featured with her entitled presentation, Cafes, Clubs, and Clandestine Cabarets, Nightlife in Montreal, and the Townships. It's captivating and eye-opening when you look and consider what is captured in a name. I sat down with Professor Cook to hear what people can expect and what is behind her work. Here we go on 99.1. Okay, Dr. Natalie Cook, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much, and do call me Natalie.
Okay, very well. Could you give us your title? You're a professor at McGill.
Yes, I'm now back in the English department, so I'm a professor of English.
And a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada, I read as well?
As of 2 days from now.
Woo!
I'll be inducted in 2 days.
Oh, congratulations.
So that's exciting.
Very much so. From what I read, you're a specialist in literary food studies and material culture. Can you give us an idea of what exactly are literary food studies and culture in the context of material?
Sure. Basically, I look at how food has changed over time, how our food ways have changed. So what we choose to eat and who we decide to share that with and where we like to eat has changed. But I don't look at food specifically. I look at texts about food. So things like menus or letters or recipe books or documents about the food that we've eaten, things like journals.
In my research, I saw a video of you with the Royal Society of Canada, actually, and you were explaining that commonplace objects are actually, loose quote here, are a testament to who we are and who we hope to become and how culture is built. Can you explain more about that? It's fascinating.
Yes. So, you know, if we were speaking, say, 100 years ago, we wouldn't actually be speaking on radio, but let's say we were speaking 100 years ago. Chances are you would not believe me if I said that throwaway items like scraps of paper with recipes or manuscript cookbooks were actually really important documents. You would think they might be useful for you and your family to prepare food that's tasty or food that you like. But I don't think you would think that culture rests upon that. But in actual fact, we're starting to realize that everyday documents are very, very important. So for a long time, we thought of history as the history of the victors, the history of the kings and queens and the leaders of countries. But the average everyday life of the individual was very difficult to discern. And in about the 1980s, we started to look at cookbooks and we were intrigued. We started even to look at magazines, you know, throwaway magazines like Chatelaine or Chatelaine.
And, Reader's Digest. It's your catalog, the Roblox.
Or Eaton's catalog, right?
Right.
The things that you aspire to have, or the things that the recipe book told you you could cook or you might like to cook, but it didn't really tell us what people were really having at home on their tables. And that's where the scribbled recipes come in with splatters on them to show that they've really been cooked. That shows us what people were doing in their own homes, and it gives us a rare glimpse into our food ways. So what we actually ate, and the stories we tell through the foods that we choose and the people we share those foods with.
Wow. I don't think we give a lot of consideration to that in everyday life, but the food you see on your counters in your kitchens or in the grocery aisles vary greatly when you travel, when you move around, or just in generations.
Yeah, it's huge. And I mean, you know that when you go and you visit a friend and you open somebody's fridge, And you see that it's just organized differently from your fridge at home. It tells you how their organization systems work. It shows you the kinds of foods that they've decided to put into their bodies. So, and it may not be the same as what they're saying they put into their bodies. We know nutritionists know that. They know that when they ask what you really ate last week, it may not be the same thing as if you took a picture with your phone.
Right. Or you take your
Right.
winter clothes out of storage and you're like, how did that button move an inch?
Oh, I know. So it's called, the official term for it is it's the difference between prescriptive food practice and descriptive food practice, what people tell you to eat and what you actually eat. So I'm interested in descriptive food practice, textual foodways.
Okay. I was shared a press release on your research and such, and that it uncovers the hidden stories told by these menus and textiles and everyday artifacts. And what jumped out to me was the line that said it reveals how their forms, codes, and designs shape what we remember and how we read. How we
Yes.
read and
Yes.
what we remember. Please explain.
Well, let me give you an example. So I'm a literature professor, and so I teach students that the message of a text is quite different based on the form of the text. So in other words, if you read a sonnet, chances are that the message in that sonnet will feel very different than if that message showed up in a 650-page novel. For
Okay.
example, all right, so there's the most extreme example I can give you of a form actually changing the message. So it wasn't a huge leap to move from sonnets to menus, but menus are more complicated because they have a lot of different dimensions on which they're communicating. So not only is it a short text that tells you supposedly what you're going to be able to eat, it actually doesn't. I argue it hides it a lot. It's short text, but quite often it's illustrated, and it's the layout is very strategic. Modern menus are our menus today, are directing your eye as a consumer to very specific things so that the restaurateur can sell particular things on the menu.
Right.
Sometimes the language is, to use a technical term, bogus. We have the advantage of being able to speak French and English here in Quebec. So we know that some of these French menus are not really French.
Not at all.
Right? They're using something called menu French,
Okay.
which is a kind of lingo that was developed to convey sophistication because people believe French cuisine was very sophisticated. So, you put à la mode at the end of pie and you get something delicious,
A dollop of ice
right?
cream, right,
Exactly.
but so much more pomp to it in that way.
Exactly. So much more pizzazz. So there are a number of different ways that we can look at a menu and look at the stories it's telling implicitly that you have to infer by reading around and between and through the lines.
I don't think, at least for myself, I'm not looking at a menu in that scope with that lens, but it says so much.
It
Wow.
does. And for example, one of the things I did in a menu course with students is I looked at a Christmas menu from 1870,
Oh.
Paris, very fancy restaurant that you probably know called Restaurant Voisin, right? And so the royalty were gathering to have Christmas dinner and they were eating consommé d'éléphant
Oh my,
and
okay.
chat flanqué de rat. And they were civet de kangaroo, for example, and some extraordinary wines.
So very exotic, right?
Exactly, S very exotic, but quite distasteful for us. And actually distasteful for the royals at the table as well. It was the 99th day of the siege, and so they were reduced to eating the zoo. And it was only the royals who had the opportunity to eat the zoo in this extraordinary restaurant. And so you can interpret, French cuisine through the language of that menu. So for example, civet de kangaroo, normally it would be hare, civet de lièvre.
Mm.
but they decided to choose another animal that hops. You know, they put the cat surrounded by rats because the integrity of the predator and the prey had some symbolic resonance to it. But they had enough wine to last. Their stores and supplies of wine were extraordinary.
Priorities.
Yeah.
Right.
So there's an example of a menu where there are huge stories to tell. And for those of us who are perhaps unfamiliar with the Siege of Paris, that one page speaks volumes, you know, more than reading a history book. And then I can put the menu of about a week prior of the Prussian army, who was just next door, actually, in the Palace of Versailles. And they're eating very traditional fare. They're eating beef and lamb because, of course, they aren't under siege. They have food supplies. So that's an example that of these very short documents speaking volumes.
Fascinating.
You're tuned in to 99.1, your community radio station, and this is the Township's Daily News Bits with Professor Dr. Natalie Cook. She recently published a new book entitled Tastes and Traditions, A Journey Through Menu History, which has so much to tell us and show us. Let's jump back into our conversation with the professor.
On November 18th, you'll be speaking at Bishop's University as part of the Robin Burns Lecture, and your presentation is titled Cafes, Clubs, and Clandestine Cabarets, Nightlife in Montreal and the Townships. Wow, what a poignant title. Please speak to us about this.
Pardon the alliteration. I couldn't resist,
It's
right?
excellent.
So listen, the book I've just published has 190 images. It's
Okay.
a picture book. It's published by a British publisher and it's been distributed internationally, right? And so I managed to sneak a few Canadian menus, but my publisher kept saying, this is an international audience. They want to see international menus. Give me more European, give me Asian, give me North American. So you will find Canadian menus in there. But when I started to speak about the book around my hometown, and I realized that I wanted to give more examples of local restaurants and how the menus can show us our own history and how that's changed over time. I looked at a series of menus and I started to develop some ideas about how we could think about restaurants around us evolving over time. And once I did that, I realized Montreal's history as Sin City,
Right.
right? I won't say anything about the townships right now, you know?
Go for it.
Montreal's history as Sin City was, you know, propelled onto the global stage because of Prohibition. So American tourists came north to Montreal and they discovered our nightlife. And Montreal became an exciting city. And the townships benefited a lot from being close to the border and from having, you know, an influx of tourists to look at their various establishment. And I was expecting to find a lot of restaurants, and I didn't. I found things, establishments called cafes and cabarets and clubs. And each of those terms had a different connotation. So I started to actually interpret the names of these establishments as well as the menus and to look at the stories those names could tell. And the stories in the townships in particular are pretty interesting. They're about a kind of, especially gentlemen clubs. They're genteel clubs, but we do have, you know, Glen Sutton had its Palace of Sin.
Oh my.
Yeah, which was Queen Lil's palace. There's a great portrait of Queen Lil that I'll be able to show in the PowerPoints, right? And the other thing is it brings us to the present day. So I'm speaking at Bishop's. So I'm hoping that some students will be there. And one of the excitements these days are speakeasies and clandestine clubs, right? That's
Right.
become a real fashion, you know, it's fashionable to go and frequent them. I don't think there are any in the townships. There are in Montreal.
Not that I know of, but yes, in Montreal for sure.
Business idea, university students, right? But that's our version of speakeasy, our version of the clandestine clubs today. And then I think I'll end actually by talking a little bit of there's a new great pub in Mansonville called Pineapple.
Oh, it's present day.
Present
Okay,
day.
this is news to me. Okay.
Well, the speakeasies are present day too, but Pineapple is present day. It opened about a month ago. It's great. But the question is, why is it called Pineapple?
Do we know?
Well,
Not
I
yet.
think we know. I actually I DM'd. I can say that, use that as a verb, can I? I
Yes,
DM'd
go for it.
the owner today and say, "Heads up, I'm going to be speaking about
Establishment.
your establishment," which is terrific. So we do know, because pineapple is this wonderful sign of hospitality that dates back from the 19th century, actually, when people used to rent pineapples if they had a fancy dinner party because they couldn't afford them. They were too exotic.
Rent, there was, oh my gosh, a market for renting pineapples.
Yeah, don't you rent your pineapple?
Not very often. No, I don't.
You rented a pineapple, and that way you could show your generosity to your guests and show that you were hosting an elegant dinner party. And we see that if you know what, if you drive and see elegant fences or gate posts in stone, quite often you'll see pineapples on the top of them, sculpted pineapples. That's what it's a symbol of, bounty and generosity.
Oh,
Okay.
lovely.
But an upside down pineapple these days
Yes.
signifies something else. It signifies a place where you'll find swingers.
Okay, I was getting a sexual connotation there.
Yeah, but the Mansonville pub has a right side up pineapple, and
Okay.
I think it's very much a sign of bounty. So it's I'll give it a plug. It's well worth going to visit.
I'll have to check it out.
Yeah.
Today, within the province of Quebec, we hear and see so much emphasis, both socially and financially, placed on language. And it resonates as being very political as well as central to culture. And I wondered what your thoughts are on this in today's context, if you're seeing any hidden messages.
It's a great question. We were just talking about a new establishment called Pineapple,
Right.
right?
Okay.
And if you look at the social media around Pineapple, this is an establishment that functions in French and English. It's very much a bilingual establishment. But one of the wonderful things about its iconography is it's just that, it's iconography. It's not written. So you actually see it as a visual symbol, which has huge resonance, number one. Number two, one can talk about menu French, right? So we all talk about real French and real French on signs, and we all look for and understand real French in Quebec. But there is I'm going to call it a political issue, but perhaps it's more of a cultural issue and one of a class issue, that adopting French on a menu is a way of elevating that menu, even today. And one does not have to be grammatically correct. There are rules that follow menu French that we're all quite familiar with. And you can switch languages within the same description of a dish, let's say, and not keep to the same language. And you can also adopt particular interpretations. So, what's an entrée, for example?
Okay.
I think in Quebec, we think of as an entrée as a main course, right?
Right?
And an amuse-gueule
As the
as the
appetizer.
appetizer. I was just in France and I mentioned that phrase, amuse-gueule, and of course they were horrified because it sounds quite graphic, doesn't it?
Racy.
Racy. And there were some lovely pastries that showed up at this rather elegant restaurant. And I said, "Oof, gosh, that looks like a pied de serre."
Oh,
Right?
yes, right?
And the people at the table, it happened to be actually a Michelin-starred restaurant, they looked at me.
Madame.
you could see that they understood that I wasn't trying to be rude, but clearly the
Okay.
language was quite different. So I'm taking your question and I'm moving it slightly by
Fair
saying
enough.
there are registers and linguistic registers that we see in menus and food terminology that are much more sophisticated than what we might think of as that clear division between French and English.
The hidden message or yeah,
So
right.
tonal registers and diction.
Wow, you're opening a whole new world here for me anyway. Items and things I hadn't considered or really looked at with a critical eye or thought about.
Well, it's quite fun. Once I started doing this, I realized that a lot of the menu books essentially curate images. So they take beautiful menus, and they really are beautiful, you know, and they show them to their readers so that you can flip through the book and see these wonderful images. But once I started to actually stop and read what was on the menus, I realized we were getting something very interesting. So, you know, definitions of a national cuisine, let's say, by the person who writes the menu. Or, you know, I started to think about, you know, what do we feed people who don't really need food?
Oh.
So I thought, all right, what's a menu for an angel or for the gods? So I started to look inside the spirit houses in Thailand to see if there was any consistency about what people were offering the spirits of the homes. And there was. I mean,
Okay.
it was very clear that they were offering something very similar across the spirit houses. So there was definitely a menu for the gods that was a kind of shared cultural assumption about what would be appropriate to feed them.
What was heightened? What was elevated?
Yeah.
A gift.
Exactly. Do you want to know what it was?
Yes, please.
Red Fanta. It was sweet red pop,
What?
along with fruit and along with other things.
I was just searching. I'm like, is Fanta the same for me as it is for her?
Yes, it is. Isn't that wild?
Wow.
Well, I think there must have been some kind of symbolic resonance with blood, right? That it was the
Okay,
sustenance.
urine.
So, you know, think of our the mass, you know, what we perceive to be the body and wine, right? Plus, it actually was a sugary drink that did provide sustenance, along with fruit and along often with some sweet things. I mean, Thailand does a really good job with its Buddhist monks of essentially a social safety net, right? That people provide food for those young Buddhist monks when they need sustenance. Call me an unbeliever, but I think there are humans who probably go and nosh on the delicacies of the spirit houses.
You just never know. Wow. This is all really intriguing. And with all this focus on food, if I could go another way, I have to ask, are you a foodie yourself? And what does draw you to this subject matter if you're not?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I'm going to have to make a confession. My last name is Cook, and I'm not a foodie. Right?
Okay.
No. But essentially, food is probably one of the best ways we can validate changes in supply and demand over time, in the same way that menus are fabulous historical documents because they have dates and places on them. Right?
Right.
So I can look at a menu and see that they're offering real turtle, and I know that real turtles are available and they haven't been overfished. I'm going to call it fishing for turtles.
Okay.
They haven't been overfished and they are affordable in that context. But then I can identify the specific moments where we start to see mock turtle on
All
menus,
right.
right? So it becomes important to have that dish, that elegant dish, but for various reasons, affordability, for overfishing, we're not able to see the turtles. Similarly, in Quebec, we can see when tortière suddenly becomes not a pie that contains birds, but is a pie that's linked or associated with pork, right? Because we see an over a lack of supply of ready birds. So in the early days of Quebec of Nouvelle France, people didn't were not relying on butcher meat for their table and for their protein. They were able to go out and collect things pretty easily. They were able to stand in the river and put their hands down and collect the meals. And that was very useful because on Fridays and Sundays, when you had no meat days, if you were a Catholic, you had fish available to you without paying too much. And you were able to take a net out and literally just plunk it on top of, the birds outside by the trees, so that the tortellerelle and the tort, could be made into a pie, and you'd have this ready meat. So you'd only rely on butcher meat in the lean months.
What a different time.
But looking at particular cookbooks and menus, we can identify the specific moment when that supply and demand changes. So I look at food because that's how we can find moments of pivotal change very precisely, and also start to see lines of tenacious continuity.
I'm seeing the references you're bringing up, like the shifting in values in social classes and the economy, how it changes in time and what's available. And
But those are very broad concepts, aren't they? As much, or at least I find it's much more telling if I have a specific object or an artifact in front of me that gives me a date, a time, and a place, and I can say, aha,
boom, right.
boom, And so that's what these textual artifacts of our foodways do.
Well, I hope that provided you all with a little bit of food for thought. That was Professor Dr. Natalie Cook, who will be lecturing over at Bishop's University on Tuesday, November 18th in the Claghorn McGreer 200. So that is a free event that runs from 7 to 9 p.m., and we invite you all in droves to attend. And a big congratulations to Dr. Cook for being officially inducted as a fellow into the Royal Society of Canada on Friday, November 14th, 2025. What an honor. Thank you goes out as well to Etienne Dominique, the director of the Eastern Townships Resource Center, for pulling this interview together. The Township's Daily News Bits is brought to you through the Local Journalism Initiative, funded by the Government of Canada. I'm Holly Bailey, signing off.